Very pretty, even with all the construction. So, I'll be talking about, I'll be talking about the effect of conformal theories, and I'll tell you what I mean by that, and why we should expect, when we should expect such a thing to exist and make sense. And then that'll be most of what I talk about, and then at the sort of end, I'll talk a little bit about the connection to flat space, limit of ADS. So this is based on work that I did with Ami Katz at BU, and also with David Poland, who's here in the audience. So you should feel free to ask him questions later if you're curious. And also David Simmons Duffin, who is a grad student at Harvard. And so this is on archive. I also want to mention there was an important paper that inspired a lot of the questions we were interested in by the following people: Heem Skirk, Panadonis, who is here, and Polchinski, and James Sully. And this is, I think, a really beautiful paper that came out about a year ago, where they started asking questions in a very precise way about what sort of qualities a CFT had to have in order for it to have ADS, local ADS descriptions. So I'll start with outline and motivation, and I will sort of spend a bit of time on motivation because I'm going to be going through a lot of formalism, and I want to sort of convince you that it's worth it to stick with me. So I want to tell you what the main questions are. So the thing that I'll really be spending time on is trying to understand how it is that we take a lot of our intuition about effective field theory in ADS, where we know really a lot. I'm an effective theorist, field theorist. A lot of us are effective field theorists. This is how we do things. We know how to calculate things. We know sort of why effective field theories, how they make sense, what constraints they should satisfy, and try and translate that into statements about the CFT, what exactly that means. And in particular, what sort of CFTs even correspond to effective field theories in ADS. So, in general, when we're doing any kind of model building in RS or any kind of supergravity calculation, we're thinking of an effective theory where we have some cutoff of the theory, and then below that we have some finite number of states with light masses. Say it could be the dilaton, there's always the graviton, etc. And an important point which makes effective field theories work is that all sort of higher dimension interactions, all relevant interactions, are necessarily suppressed by some scale. So we can ask what this looks like from the point of view of the CFT, and why this should happen, how special this is. And I want to emphasize that naively, this looks like a very special thing, right? If we ask sort of in the, imagine the sort of whole space of conformal field theories, what ones have ADS effective field theory duals, is this sort of a very special thing, or is this a very broad class? Naively, it seems right away like this is in just an enormous number of conditions that we have to impose on the CFT. That is, every interaction we can write down in ADS, we can just turn a crank, calculate in principle what correlation functions that gives rise to. For instance, in the four-point function, every single one of these guys of the form phi to the 4 with derivatives will give a new contribution to the four-point function. That four-point function of Bayes conformal symmetry looks like a perfectly good CFT. However, Nothing in that depended on these guys being suppressed by some scale. So it seems like if we want to have a CFT where the ADS dual is something that we know how to do calculations with and we know how to use, we have to go in and, you know, term by term, we have to set all of those structures to be suppressed. So this looks like, naively, like this is an infinite number of conditions. And that would sort of say that when we do any kind of RS model building, we're actually focusing on very, very special class of CFTs, that we're not really covering very much ground. So, yeah, you can rephrase this by saying sort of how special is RS. You know, the alternative to this would be that somehow the CFT does know about irrelevant interactions, that if they're unsuppressed, then they are sick in some way. And so I'm going to argue in this talk for the second of these, that it is in fact true that the CFT knows that that irrelevant interactions in ADS have to be suppressed by some scale. Otherwise, this leads to violations of, within the CFT. And so that there's actually, instead of being an infinite number of conditions that the CFT has to satisfy, there are actually a small number of conditions that they have to satisfy. And I'm going to try and talk in, I'm trying to use the word interactions in this talk to avoid confusion for local terms in an ADS Lagrangian. And I'll try and reserve the word operator for local CFT operators, because it's easy to get confused about the difference between this kind of thing, which is really just an interaction and is deforming what the ADS theory is, versus CFT operators, which I can put inside correlation functions in general. So I'll try and stick to this language, but I might slip up a little bit. And the second thing that I may or may not have much time to talk about, I want to mention how going through a new way of thinking about ADS will lead us to a simple way of calculating the spectrum of operators in the CFT dual to ADS theories. In general, the way of calculating such things is quite difficult. You have to do something like calculate some Witten diagram, which gives you the full correlation function, and then you want to extract terms which correspond to anomalous dimensions, and then you want to project them onto specific conformal blocks. And so there's a way to just, since I'm mostly going to be interested in the spectrum, this is much more information than we actually require. So there's a way to just go directly to the spectrum. And finally, I want to talk about a question that is seemingly unrelated, but is actually very tightly related, which is that given a CFT, how do we learn about the scattering amplitudes of the bulk dual in flat space? So, in general, this is fairly difficult because we're trying to do something where we learn about the we're trying to learn about something which has to do with flat space scattering, so which has to do with ADS theory in the case where I've taken the radius to be extremely large and I'm just focusing on stuff that happens in the center. But all I have to work with in order to extract this is the CFT, which lives on the boundary, and I want to somehow remove boundary effects. So I'll talk about a very straightforward, precise way of taking the spectrum of operators in the CFT and just putting those together in order to give you at least the leading order S matrix for this flat space limit of the bulk theory. Okay, so in order to do all this, I'm going to review what I would call the sort of the Weinberg approach to field theory and try and apply it directly to ADS. So we'll be developing what I would call the ADS-CFT Weinberg approach. Where what I mean by this is sort of the approach that he takes to Lorentz invariant field theory, where he looks at if you start off just with a theory of particles and you're trying to make that consistent with quantum mechanics and Lorentz invariants, how that forces us into talking about local Minkowski-Lagrangians. And how it is that just these constraints, particles plus quantum mechanics plus Lorentz invariants, leads to quantum field theory in Minkowski space. And so to try and be maximally provocative, I'll call this the Minkowski-Lorentz invariant field theory correspondence. And this is something that we're all extremely used to, and is sort of built into our way of thinking, which is why I want to go through it and review how it works in order to just take it directly over to ADS-CFT, because I want to talk about ADS-CFT as exactly these ideas just applied to conformal field theories. So, this is sort of how we think about things. We sort of take for granted that these are exactly the same, but it wasn't always obvious. If I, had a time machine, I could go back to to 1905, and I could write a paper saying that I conjecture this Minkowski-Lorentz invariant field theory correspondence. I could also steal lots of other ideas from the future and publish them in 1905. Also, if I had a time machine, I would probably publish that too. But it's a Gundonkin experiment; it's not really realistic. So, to start, let me remind you what we mean. What we mean by these assumptions. What does it mean to have a Lorentz invariant theory of particles? So there are various ingredients that go into this. One of the most important is since we're starting with the theory of particles, we have something that looks like a Fock space. That is to say, we have a vacuum, we have single particle states, we have particle states, etc. And in order to organize things, it's extremely useful to introduce creation annihilation operators, which allow us to just write all states in general in the following way. And this makes it easy later on to write interactions. The second major ingredient is that we have a Hamiltonian of the theory, and we know what the energy of all these particle states is. That's just determined by Lorentz invariants. And additionally, in the free theory limit, the Hamiltonian acts extremely simply. That is, acting on two particle states, it just gives you the sum of the energies of the two particles, and so on and so forth for multi-particle states. And so this leads to a very simple way of writing down the free Hamiltonian just exactly in terms of the energy times the number operator. And so this looks exactly like a harmonic oscillator, which is why we end up being very interested in the harmonic oscillator as a starting point. So there have been various subversive elements going around saying this or that is the new harmonic oscillator, and I would just like to say that the reason the harmonic oscillator is so useful is not just that it's a solvable system. There are lots of solvable systems. What makes it so important is that it has dynamics corresponding to multi-particle states. What was that? Yeah, it is. Unfortunately, it's a forced harmonic oscillator. I think it's probably fine. Let me just move on to the next board. That'll slowly disappear. So, oh, there it goes. Actually, let me just jump the gun and do this. Okay. Very good. And so the spectrum in this limit is very simple. We just have some cutoff above which, you know, there may or may not be some new heavy states. And then below that, we have the vacuum. We have a single particle state which comes in at some mass m, and then there are boosted versions of this, and then there are two particle states where there's a jump, and then so on, and three particle states, etc. And this is the spectrum of the theory. And then finally, the last important ingredient is the Lorentz algebra, or more precisely, the Poincaré algebra, which is to say that we have a series of generators for each of the symmetries of the algebra, and furthermore, we know exactly what their commutators are with each other. So I'm not going to write them all down, but they, in general, are things like this. The Hamiltonian commutes with translations and rotations, but it does not commute with boosts, and so on and so forth. And if this were all we were ever interested in as free theories, then we would be completely done. We would have our Hamiltonian, we'd have our space, everything would be extremely simple. We would never have had to talk about quantum field theory at all. But of course, that's not very interesting. The real world has interactions, fortunately, which allows us to give seminars. And introducing such interactions into the theory is difficult. Because when we introduce interactions, we have to deform the theory in such a way that it remains Lorentz invariant. So in particular, when we introduce interactions, we have our Hamiltonian becomes the free Hamiltonian plus a new piece. And when we do that, we are able to have interactions which don't care about we're basically able to keep the translation operator exactly the same, and we, in general, in almost all cases, keep the rotation operator the same. But it's not consistent to have the boost operator be undeformed. It necessarily has some new piece just in order to make this algebra work. And putting all that in, the constraint that the interactions have to satisfy, which leads to the difficulties of constructing such a theory, is the following, which is non-trivial. And in fact, the solution to making this happen is exactly to notice that the Poincaré symmetry is just the symmetry of Minkowski space. And so we can easily make this happen if we take V to have the specific form that it is the integral of a density which satisfies various conditions. So the first condition that it has to satisfy is just that nu of x, or v of x, sorry, has to be a scalar, which is to say that under the symmetries of the Poincaré group, it transforms simply like a change in its argument. And as long as that is true, then we will see that this takes us a long way towards satisfying this condition. And we usually make this happen simply by building the interactions out of fields which have simple Lorentz transformation properties. For instance, it's easy to build them out of scalars, and then v is just some function of these guys. built in such a way that it transforms like a scalar. So once that's the case, then looking at how these commutators behave at t equals zero, we have the following relation. This commutator is simply equal to the integral over the action of the boost on this scalar function, which is determined to be the following. And t is equal to 0, so this is 0. And this then allows us to easily construct the deformation of the boost operator as the following integral over the interaction function itself. So this takes us, for this relation, this gets us this far. There's still this last piece which has to be satisfied. And so in order to make that work, we take condition number 2, which is microcausality, that is, these commute at space-life separation. And then the final piece is just the double integral over these, over the commutator of the interaction density itself at t equals 0, which is then 0. So then this part vanishes as well, and the new interacting theory is completely Poincaré invariant. And then there's one last piece, which is extremely important in our understanding of interacting effective theories, which is we know about its regime of validity. And the way this is usually analyzed is in terms of unitarity bounds. And most commonly, the optical theorem. So we know that the imaginary part of amplitudes is related to integrals over phase space, and this then gives us constraints if these amplitudes are too large. In particular, putting this into partial waves, we get what we know and love as partial wave unitarity, which is that the partial wave amplitudes have to be less than basically order 1. And so, if we know the full particle content up to some scale, which we call the cutoff, then necessarily all higher dimensional interactions have to be suppressed by that that scale to some power. And the reason is simply that if there were no new particles in the theory, then as we crank up the energy and look at the contribution from this interaction, eventually we see that that this leads to unitarity violation. And if there are no new states below lambda, then there's no way for those new states to come in and restore unitarity. And the biggest contribution those new states can give is basically something that would cancel this divided by their mass to some power. So we know that the interactions themselves have to be suppressed by at least the mass to that power. So another way of saying this is that if the new particles come in at some scale and heavy, then necessarily they come in below the scale of suppression of higher dimension interactions. So all right, so this is basically the story that you've probably all heard, though it's not something we say every day, but it's all in textbooks. But the point of going through it in such detail is that I now want to say exactly the same words talking about ADS-CFT, and I want to convince you that ADS-CFT at least at large n, is really nothing more than this. And so you shouldn't think of the duality between an ADS theory, which looks some way, and a CFT, which looks like some totally different theory, as being sort of mysterious. But you should really just think of it as no more mysterious than the fact that Lorentz invariant theories of particles, we describe them in terms of quantum field theory in Minkowski space. So so for the next five minutes, there should be no questions at all, because anything you ask me, I'm just going to say it's exactly like Minkowski space. That's not really true. I'll try and answer your questions. But my point is I really just want to carry over as much intuition as possible from the case that you are familiar with and apply that directly to ADS-CFT. So, very good. So we have, in general, I'll not be talking about the most general kind of CFTs. I will be focusing exclusively on large N CFTs. And the reason for this will become clear in a second. Basically, it's because there are perturbations around infinite N, and infinite N CFTs are extremely simple. And they basically look like the dual of something that's free. That is, they become free in an appropriate sense. Specifically, what I mean is they become mean field theories. So all correlation functions can be written as, can be broken up just into products of two-point functions. And so the reason this is called infinite N is because you get this structure if you take a gauge theory and it has an infinite rank gauge group. Basically, the two-point functions have an N or an N squared, and then when you normalize those, all three-point functions and higher, which are disconnected, get suppressed and go to zero, so the only thing that survives is these. However, it's not necessary for the CFTs to be coming from a large N gauge group. I really can just talk about large N as a definition of what I mean by large N. And this is really what I'm going to be thinking of. So large N is actually more general than that explicit construction from the CFT. So this also has various ingredients, very much like the Lorentz invariant case. So we have something that looks like a Fock space. So what do we mean by CFT particles in this case? And CFT doesn't actually have any particles, but it does have something that that looks like particles in the appropriate sense. So let me just remind you, the way this works is in radial quantization of conformal field theories, we define modes on some constant radius. And then we evolve to larger radii using the dilatation operator. And so in this case, the dilatation operator will play the role of the Hamiltonian. Sorry? Yeah, a Euclidean signature. Though, actually, it doesn't necessarily have to be a Euclidean signature. I could take the CFT and I could put it on, map the disk of the cylinder, and then I can analytically continue in time, and then it's Lorentzian. But statements are certainly easier in Euclidean space. And then I make use of the state or operator correspondence just within the CFT itself. So we have every single operator can be mapped to a state in the CFT in radial quantization, which is just that operator acting at the origin on the vacuum. So for instance, the spectrum looks like, say I have some primary state O, some primary operator O that maps to its own state, then I also will have all the descendants of that. So basically, dO is the first one that gets its own state, and d squared O, and so on. And it's useful in order to organize this to introduce a new creation operator for every single one of these guys, for the primary and all of its descendants. So I have one guy who acting on the vacuum gives me this. I have another guy who acting on the vacuum gives me its first descendant, and so on. Now, the space of states is more complicated than just the states with a single creation operator. I can also have multiple creation operators, and these are the what I'll sometimes call the two particle states of the CFT, or equivalently, I'll call them double trace operators. And I'll sort of use single particle and single trace interchangeably, and I'll use two particle and double trace interchangeably. Double trace operators are simply things like if I have O, then I can also have O squared. I can have O with some derivatives sprinkled between it to some number of powers, etc. And these things fit in the space of states rather simply. They're just more than one creation operator acting on the vacuum. So this is equal to a state which I could write this way, which is also just O squared acting on the vacuum. And then I have, again, the vacuum. I have single trace states. I have double trace states, and so on. So exactly the same as in the free theory case in Lorentz invariant. The next important ingredient is the Hamiltonian, which, as I've said, in this case is just the dilatation operator. And acting on states, it just returns, acting on eigenstates, it just returns the dimension of the operator. So I'll reserve just delta without any index for the dimension of the operator O. And it's important that the dimension of the descendants are related to this by integers. So just in general, for all the descendants of O, this is delta plus some integer. And in mean field theory, this acts very simply on all states. It acts exactly like free theory of particles. It takes the two particle states and just returns the sum of their dimensions, and so on. And so that allows us to write down very simply what the dilatation operator is, again, just as a sum over number operators. They all get their own creation operator. So every single trace state gets its own creation operator. So these are basically like, they're exactly analogous to boosted particles. Okay, so with just different momentum. Yep. And then there's one additional thing which I'll be thinking about, which is sort of unusual for CFTs, and which would have been a weird thing to consider before ADS CFT. So all this so far has sort of been the standard large N situation. But ADS CFT sort of inspires us to think about CFTs which have specifically a large hierarchy in the dimensions of operators. So what I mean by that is we have some low dimension sector. And for simplicity, I'm just going to mostly focus on the simplest possibility, where I just have a single scalar, one single trace scalar operator and nothing else. This corresponds to just having one scalar field in ADS and nothing else. And now what we have is a spectrum that looks like this. We have some cutoff in dimensions, where there may or may not be some new heavy operators. But below that, the spectrum is very simple. We just have the vacuum. We have O itself, which has dimension delta. And there's DO, which is dimension delta plus 1, and so on. And the next big jump is at O squared, which has 2 delta, and so on. Okay? And then finally, the third important ingredient is we have the conformal algebra, which has generators, the dilatations, translations, the special conformal transformations, and the Lorentz transformations. So, this is a little confusing because the same letter is used for boosts and for special conformal transformations. This is not the boosts, but in some ways it's sort of nice that it's the same letter because we'll see that the special conformal transformations have a very similar role to the boosts in the Lorentz invariant case. And so, if you ever wondered why in the Lorentz invariant case why we use K to stand for a generator called boost, now you know why. It's because it's dual to the special conformal transformations. So there are various parts of the algebra. The dilatations commute with the rotations, etc., but they don't commute with the special conformal transformations. And then there are others. And the statement that O is a primary operator is just the statement that it's annihilated by the special conformal generator. Okay, so again, this is all very simple. If we're working at infinite n, there would be no need to talk about anything in ADS. We could just write down the dilatation operator simply. We could do dual calculations this way. But what we actually are interested in is finite n. So going to finite n requires us to deform the dilatation operator away from its free theory value. But we want to keep the algebra fixed. And in order to do this, we have to deform the translations and the special conformal generators. So this requires putting in some new piece. And they have to satisfy something like the following. Plus the commutator of the dilatations with the deformation. And this has to be equal to this minus this. So, again, the way we make this happen is we just notice that the conformal symmetry in d dimensions is exactly the same as the space-time symmetry of ADS in one higher dimension. And so this matching is much simpler in ADS global coordinates, so where the spectrum is exactly what we want. So in global coordinates, which I can write as the following, this spectrum is discrete, unlike in the Poincaré patch, and it is discrete in exactly the way that matches on to the CFT and radial quantization. So, in particular, the spectrum for a field phi that satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation is just that it has some dimension delta, which is related to its mass, plus integers. And then the dilatation operator itself in global coordinates is literally the Hamiltonian. It is just the derivative with respect to global time. And so this space of states matches extremely simply between the CFT and radial quantization and the particles in ADS global coordinates. And so again, we want to introduce interactions in such a way that the new theory satisfies conformal symmetry. So the solution is to take the deformation V to be an integral of some density, which is a scalar function. The scalar function has to satisfy conditions just as before. The first condition is that it has to be a scalar. As long as this is true, then as long as this is true, then this part of the constraint is satisfied just by looking at how k acts on a scalar function. And the second condition, as before, is that it has to commute with itself for g to 6 outside the light cone. And then if that's true, then this part is killed off. Okay, so this is not the way ADS-CFT is usually stated, but I don't think it's anything anyone would have disagreed with. But we'll now use it to do something interesting, which is the piece of this picture that I think was missing before, which is how do we say what the regime of validity of this is? So in particular, what is it that goes wrong if you start to look at something that corresponds to very high energy scattering in the presence of an irrelevant operator? So in particular, this is somewhat confusing a priori because the CFT is scale invariant. Therefore, there's sort of no scale where the CFT can possibly break down. But the point is that you should think of energies in ADS as dimensions of in the CFT. And so it's actually dimensions where the CFT description starts to break down. So in order to see this, we wanted to construct something which looks very similar to the optical theorem. The optical theorem comes from unitarity S matrix, which is just a change of basis between in and out states. So something we can look at, which is extremely similar, is the change of basis between the eigenstates of the free dilatation operator and the eigenspace of the interacting dilatation operator. So this has eigenstates. This also has eigenstates. These are both complete bases. And so the change of basis going between them is necessarily unitary. So now we can ask what is necessary in order for that to be true in perturbation theory, in perturbations in 1 over n. And the easiest way to analyze that is just a simple application of time-independent quantum mechanics, where we can write the new states of the full interacting theory in terms of the eigenstates of the free theory, just using the formula that we all learned in kindergarten, that as follows, that it's basically the shift comes about from matrix elements of the interaction itself divided by the energies. Okay? And in order for me not to have to write 2 delta plus 2n every single time, let me just write this more simply as the following. There's some relation between the interacting states and the free states. In the absence of any interactions, this is just t vanishes, and this is just the identity operator. But more generally, there will be some non-trivial change of basis. And the fact that both of these spaces are complete requires the following, that if I sum over the eigenstates of the zeroth order dilatation operator, then I necessarily get the identity operator. So in particular, I get this. So this implies that the real part of the diagonal of the transition matrix has to be positive, and furthermore has to be greater than the absolute value of the real part of the transition matrix itself. So this is starting to look very much like what we're used to in the optical theorem. And furthermore, this means that the real part of the transition matrix diagonal elements has to be less than some order one number. which in this case is easy to show, that's lesson two. And we can get a constraint on the spectrum itself by applying this to one of our double trace operators with some specific value for n. So let me look at, for example, if I write the transition element as, so this is just simply the overlap between these two, the interacting and the non-interacting states, and this is just equal to the following sum. Which is, since every single contribution here is positive, this is necessarily greater than a specific interaction, which I can pick out, which is the overlap between the state 2 delta plus 2n and the nearest thing with the integer n just differing by 1. And furthermore, at very large little n, where little n is how far I've gone up the spectrum of double trace primary operators, this matrix element, 2 delta plus 2n, 2 delta plus 2n plus 2, since it's very close, there's almost no difference between these two states, this is almost exactly the same as the diagonal element itself, which is nothing more than the anomalous dimension of the state 2 delta plus 2n. So just to be clear, what I mean by the anomalous dimension is, so there's some dimension of the state 2 delta plus, which I'm calling 2 delta plus 2n, which is its dimension when at n equals infinity. It's just the dimension of the, it's just two deltas coming from the fact that it's something like two factors of O, each of which brings a factor of delta, and then there are 2n derivatives acting here. And then when n is finite, this will get contributions, this will get corrections. And those corrections are exactly the matrix elements of the dilatation operator itself. So we finally arrive at the bound that the anomalous dimensions, in order for this perturbative unitarity to hold, have to be less than some order one number, which you could strengthen, but it's easy to show it's at least 4. All right, so the reason this is very interesting is because these anomalous dimensions do know about whether or not operators are irrelevant or if they're marginal. So this is something that was shown in by Penidonis and Polchinski and friends, and it's also somewhat easier to show in using just calculating the dimension, the expectation values of the dilatation operator. But an important point that I just want to use without demonstrating it is that for an ADS interaction, which has some dimension suppressed like this, necessarily, the contribution that it gives to the anomalous dimensions grows like n to the power of the interaction itself. So the reason this lambda the p is in the denominator is just because this is a calculation you can do in perturbation theory, so this is just some coefficient. And the point now is that you have this tower of double trace operators indexed by the number n. And as you go up in n, even though these are suppressed by the big N, so unfortunately I'm using N for two things, even though these are suppressed by the fact that the interaction is very small, if you go up far enough on the tower, then for any irrelevant interaction, eventually those corrections will overtake the leading order piece, and the anomalous dimension will become greater than 4, and perturbative unitarity will be violated. So we necessarily have, in order for perturbative unitarity to be satisfied without bringing in new states in order to save the day, we necessarily have all of these higher dimension interactions suppressed in ADS at least by the scale where new states enter. So what looked like an enormous number of conditions before can actually be stated in just a small number of conditions. First of all, we want to demand that we have large n. Second of all, we want to demand that we have no new single trace states below some large dimension, a cutoff of the theory, delta heavy. And furthermore, we want to demand perturbative unitarity. And these three assumptions together necessarily imply that phi Lefort, d phi Lefort, etc., all have to be suppressed by delta heavy to some power, which depends on whether we're talking about ADS3 or ADS4 or ADS5. But so what looked like an enormous number of conditions, one new condition for every single one of these interactions, can actually be reduced to just three conditions. I don't think it was very important at all that it was a scalar. Just this was just avoided having to write down indices. Yeah.
And so there's a lot of complications there.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There are further conditions. So if you have, it's not enough. So it's true even in the vector case, right? The higher dimension interactions have to be suppressed by the scale of new physics, right? But in the case of, say, massive gauge bosons, absolutely that's not enough. You have to have further conditions. You have to have, something like Higgsian, but that doesn't change the fact that you still have to have higher dimension interactions suppressed by the scale of new physics. It just means that you have to have additional complicated structure to avoid non-unitarity in something like WW scattering.
I believe the answer, I just wondering if there's technical, I'm worried more about derivative. Same thing that happens for the gauge case happens in derivative interactions, that if you have your interaction with Brownian and typically is not, your interaction with Brownian density is not a Lorentz scalar. And in the end of the day, it doesn't change any of the power counting.
Well,
yeah. I don't know if there's a hidden assumption in your list, or is that associated with the same thing?
I'm not saying that that there might not be more conditions on the ADS. I'm saying that these conditions imply at least this, but there are probably additional conditions that you have to have. We know that there are additional conditions in the case of massive gauge bosons, right? You also have to have that. So I don't actually know if this grows like n to the p for vectors. It's only been checked for the case of scalars. But it's the fact that this grows like n to some power that depends on what the scale of the interaction is fairly straightforward to see. Basically, you can calculate interaction, these anomalous dimensions are matrix elements of the dilatation operator, and you can calculate those as basically sandwiching this between the two states, and the two states have some wave function. And the more and more derivatives you put on, you put in the interaction, the more times those derivatives act on the wave function. And the wave functions are things like, say, phi of x to 2 delta plus 2n is something like cos to the 2 delta plus 2n. And so lots of derivatives will bring more powers of n. Anyway, so I'm just saying that this exact exponent, I haven't checked. I don't think anyone's checked this is true for vector bosons, but I would be shocked if it's not true. Okay, so let me talk about, in the last 5 minutes, maybe I can go over a little since we started late. I just want to talk about the connection to scattering amplitudes in the flat space limit. So the spectrum of interactions, if you look at something like phi squared of x, interaction in ADS, you can actually to actually try and see what happens if you have a massive state coming in to save unitarity. So if you have something like this, this interaction will give corrections to the anomalous dimension of the double trace phi states, and you can just plot what this is. And what you find is, as you look at the dimension of, as you look at n, then at small n, this grows exactly as you'd expect from iterating out the massive chi particle. You get something like phi to the 4 over m chi. So this looks like it grows, and it looks like it's going to violate unitarity. But when you get to the scale corresponding to the dimension of this new heavy particle, it turns over, and then it starts falling again. And so unitarity is still satisfied. Whereas what would happen if you just wrote down a 5-4 interaction in ADS5 is that it would continue to grow and eventually violate unitarity. And so if you look at this, you might think, well, that looks a lot like a resonance. And in fact, the connection is not imaginary. There really is a tight relation between the anomalous dimensions and the scattering amplitude. And it's very easy to write down precisely. So at leading order, the flat space 2-2 scattering is exactly just the following. There's some precise coefficients, which are not especially interesting. And then there's some normalization coming from the wave functions themselves. But what's interesting then is that the anomalous dimensions, so the anomalous dimensions themselves are basically just exactly the partial waves of the flat space scattering amplitudes in one higher dimension. Okay, so if you come to me and you say, I have a CFT, I've calculated everything about the CFT, I want to know what 2-2 scattering looks like in ADS. If we wanted, we could do 3-3, it would just be triple trace operators. Then all you have to do is hand me the spectrum of interactions, the spectrum of double trace operators in the CFT, and I can just immediately take them, put them into this formula, and I can tell you what the scattering amplitudes are in the flat space limit of ADS. So I just want to give you some intuition on why a connection like this might be true, and then I'll wrap up. But at some level, there's an aspect of it which is very simple, which is that at leading order, the scattering amplitudes of the flat space theory are just the otherwise known as just the T matrix. They're just matrix elements of the Hamiltonian itself. But that's all that the anomalous dimensions are. They are also just matrix elements of the dilatation operator. So it's not so surprising. There's some connection to them. What's surprising is that you get flat space out by cranking up the dimension. And the reason this works is because primary states have a profile in ADS which tends to be doing a lot of work for you. That is, if I look at some primary state for very large little n, then it has a profile where it is extremely peaked in the center of ADS. And so all of the interactions are happening right in the center, where the theory just completely forgets about the fact that there was any curvature at all. And what you end up getting is literally T matrix elements that look like they're in flat space. So yeah, primary states live in the center of ADS. And so primary states are sort of very special in this way. And in some sense, this is sort of where the magic is. I think, you know, it was sort of, you can sort of physically argue that there had to be some way of taking CFT data and putting it together in order to get a flat space S matrix, because if you're taking R to be very large, you can just take some state which corresponds to, states scattering here in the middle, Basically, you know, we could, until a few decades ago, for all we knew, we actually did live in ADS with just some huge radius, and you know, that would, if we would have gone on and built the LHC and collided things and described them in terms of an S matrix, and we never would have cared that actually that S matrix was sort of complicated if you tried to scatter states from future and past infinity. The thing that's sort of remarkable is that you might have thought constructing such states in terms of the CFT was very complicated, but it turns out to be extremely simple. Just the primary states of the CFT already have this property. And so I'll leave you with that. That's all I wanted to say.
So you had this very nice analogy between flat spectrum and ADS, but then at some point you started analyzing this in all of dimensions. So this would be like the mass shifts in flat space?
Yeah, it would be like mass shifts if mass shifts. It's sort of hard to make sense of what the mass shifts mean in flat space. Because here you're starting with something, because you're in ADS, you already have a discrete spectrum. Whereas in flat space, you'd be starting with something which is a continuum. So any sort of, usually in flat space, putting in a little contribution to, you know, putting in some additional potential just totally changes what the wave functions are. Right? If you turn on a Coulomb potential in flat space, now the wave functions are not like plane waves at all. Now they look like, like the things that are centered. Whereas in ADS, because you already have it sort of living in a box, if you turn on some new interactions, that's not going to deform it so much.
I'm saying that because if you follow your analogy, it's not at all natural to formulate any static in terms of these normal dimensions. In flat space, we don't talk about.
Right. So I think that's one reason why it's sort of nice that it turned out that the anomalous dimensions really are the scattering amplitudes in this limit. Because you could have said, you know, why is it that these energy shifts are conveying information about unitarity and the optical theorem? You know, what are the energy shifts in flat space? But they're also very tightly related to the to scattering amplitudes, and that is exactly what we look at in order to analyze unitarity violation in flat space.
But that's just tree level.
Sure, sure. But you know, unitarity violation starts to show up at tree level, right?
Okay.
All right. Well, hope you convince you all that.
Let me also make another comment, because this analogy was so nice that you're just saying. If you're studying CFTs, you should just be doing ADS since the beginning.
You're doing more than CFTs, yeah.
But it's a fact that we know other formulations of CFTs that don't talk about ADS. So, what is this for flat space?
If you wanted to describe particles
without talking about Minkowski space.
Without talking about Minkowski space, some other formulation of what would be. I don't know, maybe we should ask the amplitude people.
I think that's what they're looking for, yeah.
Alright, so if there are no more questions or comments, let's thank you again.
That